Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
Because that's it, isn't it? That first album takes you 3 years,
to get together. All your time up until that point, everything.
And then it's like, then you're on the treadmill, and it's like, and then you've got to, and if you're incredibly successful, you're fucked, because you've got to do something as good as that, if not better, in a millionth of the time.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome Horace Panther to the show, to Curious Creatures.
How are you doing, gentlemen? What's happening?
We're all looking well. I mean, here we are.
Yeah.
Compos Mentos. We can even put a sentence together. It's quite amazing, really. Yeah. You did, the Specials did a new album. When was that now?
It came out beginning of September, and it didn't have any scar on it at all.
It was really well received, as far as I remember. Yeah. Everybody's like, were you doing it for, like, just because you fancied doing it? You just thought, hey, we're talking to each other, we should do something.
Well, the lockdown happened. We were going to make a reggae rap album. We thought, oh, no, let's do what people expect of the Specials. But then the lockdown happened. So Terry needs to, he can't write at home. He has to leave basically the country, you know, and go. There's a place in Paris, a little hotel that he sort of like.
I love that.
And then he's got some buddies in New York. No, he has to sort of remove himself from the country to have no distractions, no family.
Can I just write that one down, Horace? I'm just going to write it down so I can tell my wife, listen, I can't do any writing until I go to Paris.
Bratislava to practice, yeah. So that sort of put the album on hold. There's no way we can do that. And Limbaugh, you know, had to go back to America and all this.
Right. He lives here in California, right?
He lives in Seattle. Yeah. He lives in.
Oh, right. So he's moved a bit further.
Harbor. It's a ways from Seattle. Yeah. Out in the woods, apparently. So it's like, we couldn't do this album. So what are we going to do? So there was that gap in between lockdowns that we had. So Limbaugh came over, and Terry said, let's do a covers album. That's what bands do, isn't it? When they run out of ideas, they do a covers album. But we said, let's do an album of protest songs.
Right.
So, let's not do, your usual suspects. Let's get a bit obscure and see what we come up with. But it was a project, and it was a great excuse to get everybody back in the studio again. And we did it. And the hardest part about doing the album was choosing what songs to do. We did the whole thing in 6 weeks. We recorded it in 4 weeks, and it was mixed in two. And boof, there you go. So that's, and then we went on tour, which was wonderful. It was real, and it was one of the first tours to go out since the lockdown, which was fantastic. I think us and Elbow, we were doing the same sort of circuit, which was great. Barrowlands in Glasgow, which I'm sure you both played Barrowlands in Glasgow.
Yeah.
Bonkers at the best of times. It was the first show that they had in Barrowlands since it opened, and it was utterly mental.
they're probably still there, aren't they?
It was absolutely fantastic.
That's my memory. When anybody says to me, "Oh yeah, you played with the Specials back in the day," and I was like, "Yeah." The thing I remember is that first festival we did together, and it was like bonkers out the front, you know, and it was such a good energy. I mean, it was brilliant. It was like punk on steroids, but with like some kind of swing. There was some kind of rhythm going on. It wasn't just, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. It was great, you know. So what do you remember about those years?
That show, that was at the Bilson Festival.
And it was
August 1979.
Yeah.
That was one of the, I can honestly say that was the best Special show ever for me.
Yeah, I'll agree with you. I'll agree with you about that, yeah.
Because we just signed our record deal. We hadn't even bought new equipment. This was all the gear that we'd like stolen or hand-built or borrowed, you know, do all our sort of club shows and all this kind of stuff. And we took it, put it in a van, and it got driven over to Belgium. And and we didn't know what the fuck was. I mean, we'd done our club shows. We knew we were good. And there was you guys. There was Bram Tchaikovsky.
Hmm? Yes. Yes. Wow.
Us lot, the Pretenders, the Police, and AC/DC. Yeah. And you guys played.
Yeah.
And then Bram whatever played. And then while we set up, I think we had roadies, but they were just Neville's mates and they weren't particularly good.
Always.
But then we went on and just fucking destroyed the place. And it was amazing. Yeah. It was because nobody had heard of us apart from a couple of kids who'd come all the way from Coventry to see us. And we just went on there and just did what we did. And there was this big chain link fence in about 12 foot in front of the stage, and it got ripped up, and everyone charged into the lip of the stage, and it was fucking fantastic. And
that was
the one gig that sort of made me think, oh gosh, what we're doing is really, really amazing.
it was absolutely spectacular because it was joyous. It was like a joyous riot.
Yeah.
That's the way I think about it. It was like everything you really like when you're young about music, you know, like it had that power. And just to see, you know, Neville running backwards and forwards across the stage constantly, you know, and then Roddy coming out now and again and stuff.
Yeah.
And in the middle of the storm, Terry just standing there and yourself anchoring it was great.
This is life-changing moment. This is
it was in a way. Every other gig we did after that, as far as I was concerned, was like, was that as good as Bilson? You know, honestly, that was before we'd recorded our first album and did the two-tone tour and all that. And had even discovered who Madness were.
That's obviously the gig that people say, yeah, but I saw them at that gig. It was never as good again.
Well, it's kind of like the people that always said, oh, yeah, I was at the Pistols at the 100 Club. And if everybody who saw the Pistols at the 100 Club was there, there would have been 20,000 people there. But, you know.
Same vibe when the Clash and the Sex Pistols played at the Lounge, you know, in 1970, whenever it was, 7. Yeah. I had a gig. I was in a show band at the time, and I had a gig on that evening. And I walked past the venue. It was the Lancaster Polytechnic where I used to study, and they were sort of setting up, and with all the Clash had their fluorescent pink equipment and all that sort of stuff.
And the Pistols had no equipment, right?
I didn't see this stuff. But anyway, and then I did my gig around the corner at the Smithfield. And then sort of, with my guitar case, walk back and as they were sort of loading out and everything.
What tour games did the Specials get up to? Did you have like Monopoly on the go or?
No, God, you're joking. No, because it became sort of factionalized quite early on. Because that was the Specials. Oh, Horace, what are you doing reading a book? You know what I mean?
Oh.
No, everybody was sort of had their own little sort of...
Little camp.
Yeah.
we took our love of like things like Sibutio.
Yeah.
And I remember playing Sibutio backstage with The Cult. Only there was early, you know, with
Southern Death Cult.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like, not just making teams up backstage. Yeah. And Banshees were big games players, you know, Cluedo and Yahtzee and
yeah.
Wow.
Because we never went out, you know, we just hung out in somebody's like flat, usually the manager.
Right.
Because none of us really had anywhere to go.
Wow. As we started getting to play the, you know, the Enormo domes on tour, we started playing the crew at football, which was not a great idea because, you know, we'd end up like smashing the ball into the side of these buildings and then have this huge bill from the establishment to repaint the wall.
We never did anything sort of, you know, recreationally together.
Right.
But we weren't mates. You know what I mean?
Okay.
There are two types of groups, aren't there? There's like the people who are mates and they want to be mates forever because they're mates. And so they'd learn to play instruments together and off they went.
Right.
And there's the group where there's one guy who goes, I have the master plan. And in order for me to realize it, I need the drummer, the bass player, the keyboard player, the whatever. And that was the Specials. So everyone was kind of cherry picked for their musical ability and all that.
Right.
But all that, the people skills stuff came later or didn't come at all. You know,
it
was weird. And I always think that although we, in 1979, when we were a gang, when we were all facing the same direction and we had something to prove, we were unstoppable. But then once we started getting money, you know, but we were all different. There was the class thing, and not a lot of people go on about the class thing in the Specials. But me, Brad and Jerry all had fine art degrees.
Right.
You know, we had BAs, whether we told anybody or not, you know. Neville and Linval both came to England on the boat from Jamaica,
yeah.
You know, in the 60s. And Terry and Roddy were the children of the archetypal, you know, Coventry working class who worked in, I think Terry's dad worked at Courtauld and Terry and Roddy's dad worked at the Jag. You know, it's like typical, right. You know, motor industry people. So there was that. I didn't have a great deal. The only thing we had in common, really, was the music we played. So it was kind of weird. So we had to get to know one another while we were in the back of a transit going to, you know, Derby or somewhere.
That's
wow.
And it was strange. So because I honestly think that I didn't really have that many conversations with Terry Hall during, you know, in the original. But you didn't have to because there were seven of us. So, you know what I mean? It wasn't like we were like you guys lot where there was only three of you.
Right. Right.
Well, you know, but there was tons of us, you know.
Yeah, that's funny because that's totally opposite to my experience because, you know, Michael, Robert,
yeah,
we were all at school together, you know, and so the band came out of that. So you're right, we learned how to play together and later on, you know, different people came in that we ran out of mates to put in the band, basically.
Yeah, employed musicians. Yes,
right. So we sort of started the reverse way round and then ended up the other way.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of funny.
It's funny because now I'm really good friends with Limbo and I'm really good friends with Terry. You know what I mean? We don't talk every day. We don't talk every week.
No.
But we know that when we're together, that it's like, yeah, okay, I've got your back and they've got mine. It's funny. We slag one another off quite a bit to one another. But if anybody else does, watch it, mate. You know, that's my band. You know what I mean? It's weird. That's evolved over a long, long time.
Horace, you were saying like that you had a show band.
So yes.
Punk came along and you'd already cut some time playing.
The thing with the Specials is that we knew how to play.
Right.
We were a couple of years older. I mean, Terry was an original punk. I mean, he you know, went to see the Sexers and the Sex Pistols and the Clash and it was the epiphany. Whereas I was walking past that gig to go to my show band gig. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we were a bit older, so we'd done our apprenticeship. You know, we played discos or working men's clubs and sort of knew how it went on. But we were, I was just thrilled with the energy of it, because I also remember a mate of mine getting the first MC5 album, you know, kick out the jams, motherfuckers, when I was still at school. And it's like, wow, that's good. The first pop concert I ever went to, which was in 1969, I was 15, and I went to the Royal Albert Hall and I saw Led Zeppelin. And it scared the shit out of me. I'd never heard anything so loud in my life. And bear in mind, I was brought up in Kettering, Northamptonshire, you know, tiny little East Midlands market town. Nothing ever happened in Kettering. But I got a train down to London and my mind was blown. It was great. So, but yes, the Specials knew their stuff. So it wasn't like we were sort of punching down or anything, you know, because the... I was learning a new musical style. I could play funk, soul, blues, kind of stuff reasonably well. But then it's like, now listen to reggae. You know, where what the? How does it? I don't get that at all. You know, but then you know, I learned about Linval and Desmond Brown, who was the keyboard player in the Selector. They would come round to my flat and give me reggae lessons. It was really funny.
I had to wait a little bit. I kind of grew up on my slightly older friends down the street who had motorcycles and things. They were into Tamla Motown.
Yeah.
So I, you know, all the Motown Chartbusters albums always had these great covers. But I wasn't too into the music, but what I made my own was the Reggae Chartbusters albums.
Right.
With the Simmerups and the Israelites, Desmond Dekker, Lee Scratch Perry and the Upsetters. But I never tried to play it, but it got rooted in there somewhere.
Yeah, that feeling. I was aware of that as music. But I didn't know how to play. I had problems playing the songs that I did like. I had problems playing the songs that I could play. But you know, so to actually take on this new style of music was a big deal. But very exciting, very interesting. But actually playing it with the real black people who played it. You know what I mean? Because I was middle class art school kid. Linval Golding was the first black person who I ever met in my life, and actually sat down and talked to. And I was like, that was after I left college. So I was like 25, you know, small, middle class market town in, you know, and I went to art school, for Christ's sake, you know. So I didn't meet hardly any people of colour until I met Linval. So it was a big deal to be actually in a group with these people who were, you know, they were the real deal, that they knew how to play it. Yeah.
I think the only thing I had over anybody in Liverpool was, because I'd been in like the little show band, I knew how to rehearse. I knew what kind of time you had to put in. And so all I could do was like say, and it seems that the people that made it were the ones that were able to put in time to rehearse.
Mm.
I think, Lowell, you spent a long time formulating the first Cure songs, right?
Yeah, we were... Robert's parents built this extension on their house, and the idea was that they were going to have, you know, family get-togethers and parties, and we just moved all of our gear into there. We just, like, I put my drum kit in one night, and then Mick bought his amp, and we stuck it in there. And for 3 years, we didn't leave that room. Like, you know, they were like, can we do Christmas in there now? And then we're like, no, we've still got to work some songs out. And we basically, after 3 years, we couldn't play still, but we could play our songs. We knew how to play the stuff that we had written.
Yeah. You didn't have to be as good as Carlos Santana before you got on a stage. And you didn't need an enormous lighting room. And you could. I wish you'd have seen the band that Terry Hall was in when we were getting the Specials together. Squad, they were fucking amazing. They were really good. None of them could play. But they wanted to.
Yeah.
And Terry was just this amazing front man. And sometimes, and they always used to support us, you know, when we were called the Automatics or the Hybrids or whatever. And sometimes he would like turn his back on the crowd and sing facing the drummer and all this kind of stuff. And they probably had 20 minutes worth of material, but they were mesmeric. They were amazing. really. But that was it. It was great. And there were loads of bands like that. All of a sudden, the whole sort of Coventry just right. off, and it was great. And like four nights a week, you could see groups in pubs. And some of them were great, and some of them were rubbish, but it didn't matter. It just, scene sort of happened, which just wasn't there, 2 years previous. Great.
Is it because there was nothing else for anybody to do and it filled the gap?
I feel so. I think so. Because, I mean, you remember the middle of the 70s in England was pretty dire. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of strikes going. It was pretty miserable. I mean,
discontent.
Yes, discontent. Yeah. For us, the band was a social thing as well, because we were like, okay, rather than go down the pub and have to, you know, deal with the skinheads down the pub, we'd sit at Robert's house and make music, and that was it. So it was a social thing because there wasn't anything else to do, you know.
Yeah. Music's just transcendental, isn't it? I mean, it transcends stuff. And I learned this sort of early on, that playing music was the best. It was great. Yeah. You know, what a fantastic thing to do. And especially, I started up, I suppose, as a pop music nut, listening to music and buying records and being a fan, and then sort of gradually getting to the fact where I could actually play the stuff. Wow, it was when I first learned to play with other people. It was the greatest thing ever. Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah. It certainly saved our souls, I think, in many ways. Yeah.
And I do recall in Liverpool that there was a massive thing happened when the first Kraftwerk album came out. It was like Kraftwerk and Heroes and The Idiot. So Trans Europe Express came out at the same time. And we were just being pulled all over the place. There was this like electronic beats and a kind of old rock, but given a new twist. It was like anything seemed to be possible. And all that was going on at the same time as the people who couldn't even string a chord together.
Mm. Right.
And just jumping up on stage. And then you got something like Wire came along.
Right.
Who didn't put any lights on and refused to talk to anybody. And we're all done in 20 minutes. Yeah. And then like the Ramones came over, and then Blondie, and then Talking Heads. All these things came together at once. It was intense.
Like 77, there was a real juxtaposition, because Bowie put out Low, which definitely influenced us. I mean, you know, like Dennis Davis' drum sound. I mean, you know, it's just genius, right? And the Clash's first album was out. So we had those two things going on, you know, with us and that. And then we'd take something from the past as well, like Nick Drake, because it was very miserable, you know, but beautiful, and meld that together, and that becomes who you are.
Yes.
Right? And so for us, that was it. You know, we had distilled all this stuff, but couldn't really play it. So the way we played it wrong became the way The Cure sounded. Yeah,
I get it. It's funny. I was thinking about Scar, you know, the other day, and I was listening to some of these American Scar bands, and they play it really fast.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, fucking how dreadful. But I was thinking back, I remember that when the Scatterlights first heard the Specials, fucking hell, they're playing it far too fast. You know, it's exactly the same. So basically, Horace Sharp let them get on with it, because that's how they're interpreting it. That's how they're playing their music. Who am I to tell them what's right and what's wrong? But that's how it works, isn't it?
Yeah. Was there an album that kind of changed your thinking?
I don't know. Playing ska and reggae did not come naturally to me. No, it was I think I had the Garvey's Ghost, the Burning Spear. Yeah. I listened to that a lot. And, of course, that live Bob Marley album. With No Woman, No Eye on, which was great, but at the time I was into Little Feat, you know, I was into Rhythm Sections, you know, the Meters and all this kind of stuff, and really sort of funky stuff. Headhunters by Herbie Hancock, you know, fucking amazing, good.
Yeah.
And so I was into like that sort of funk dance music and stuff, and then so it wasn't that much of it. But no, I think in terms of reggae, it was probably that live Bob Marley album. There was a 12-inch. There was a Revolutionaries 12-inch, which was like Heartache, Bellyache, Toothache, and something else I can't remember. I didn't like The Clash. When we first played with them, it scared the shit out of me. I was like, this is really violent and this is horrible. And it reminded me of football matches. But then after we played with them for like a couple of 3 weeks, it's like, wow, this is really exciting. I can deal with this. So it was weird. I was not a punk from the off. You know what I mean? I was into soul, funk, whatever, you know, and then move my way into all that. So I wouldn't say there was one album that did it. My favorite album of all time is Exile on Main Street by the Rolling Stones.
I mean, you know, I listen like religiously to Brown Sugar, Sticky Fingers. Right. Sticky Fingers album. I don't know what, I think it might have been the Warhol cover with the zip.
Yeah.
Which ruined everything.
Yes, I wish up all the other albums you had.
I was really proud of it. You know, I loved Alice Cooper's Schools album.
Yeah,
I could understand the music. I could hear the drums and what they were doing. I thought I can figure out what they're doing.
Yeah,
there was like a way in. There's a little way in, and then there was a simplicity of Mark Bolan and T-Rex, which was like pop music.
Yeah.
That's another album that we bonded over. Electric Warrior.
Electric Warrior was one that Susie brought out every party, you know. Yeah. So I knew that we were the same age. We came up at the same time. But those couple of years are really, the difference in our ages makes such a big difference at that moment in time.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. That sort of, you know, 4 or so years, there's a real difference between, you know, because I don't know, I grew up listening to the pirate radio stations, you know, in 1964, 65, 66.
Yeah.
underneath the blanket, whatever it was you had on your bed.
It was a big deal. I went to the BBC and I was interviewed by Johnny Walker on his Radio 2 thing. I was thrilled because he was one of the big deals on Radio Caroline.
So what's life like now for Horace Panther?
I have very little to complain about. I'm worried about being nearer 70 than I am 65, and I'm a rock star. I mean, how fucking ridiculous is that? the specials are still going. I'm playing with a Zydeco and Cajun band that I've met.
Oh, wow!
Some people from Derby. Wow. That is fantastic. It's so good because it's like it's country, it's blues, it's really funky. And I've got a couple of gigs with them stretching into next year. I'm playing a blues high octane power trio thing, and I'm still painting pictures as well.
Good,
which is good fun.
Have you always been painting?
It was always the thing, you know. Whenever you know we being in the special, sort of fabulous excuse to go and visit. You know, travel the world and see some of the world's great art galleries. So it was always a thing that I did. But then I was an art teacher. I became an art teacher. I taught in this special needs school. And from like 1998 to 2008, like 10 years more or less. Wow, and then they called me up. But so art was always a big deal. Once we'd reformed, we had all this downtime. So I started painting sort of seriously, if you like, and had all these pictures. And one day my wife came in and says, well, I reckon we could sell these. And so it sort of started like that.
So what was that like? Was that like your sojourn? Like, you know, like Leonard Cohen became a Buddhist monk for 10 years, right? And then came back towards the end of his life and started, you know, doing music and stuff again. But for that 10 years, he was just like completely removed from it all. So when you were doing the art, were you doing any music or are you just like...
Yeah, I've played, you know, there's a little blues band that I've been working with. It doesn't do so much work at the moment, but we would play at least like once a fortnight. In Coventry, and I had I worked with Neil Davis, the guitar player from The Selector. We had a blues piece for a while, which was really good. So I've always played. There hasn't been a, you know, it's not like, you know, the guitars are stuck away under the bed or anything. No,
right.
Cool. Do you feel busier now?
When the Specials are, but I think that's good, because back in the day, I don't know about you guys, but it's like when you're hot, whether you're cold, you know, whether you don't want to or not, and it's like that. Yeah. That was horrendous. That I think that was the demise of the Specials, was like a punishing with a capital P.
We never stopped, right? Did you? You never stopped.
No, and until you split up. You know, he's like a German fighter pilot in the Second World War. You never had time off.
Why did nobody ever say, guys, take a break?
Yeah. Take a month off. We had the first 5 years, we were just like non-stop.
Yeah.
Album to album. And no wonder we were at each other's throats by the end of it, you know?
Yeah. I think our record company, because we were so successful so quickly, and our manager was like, oh shit, what's all this about? And the record company were going, oh great, fantastic, next album, right, 6 weeks time, okay great, fantastic. On tour, you know, Japan. Yeah. And it's like, whoa, hang on, you know, because that's it, isn't it? That first album takes you 3 years.
Yeah.
You know,
all your time up until that point, everything.
And then it's like then you're on the treadmill, and it's like and then you've got to, and if you're incredibly successful, you're fucked, because you've got to do something as good as that, if not better, in like a millionth of the time. So it was just dreadful. Plus we all change, because when we were broke and had something in common, then you become, you know, then you get money and start taking the wrong kind of drugs and drinking too much and blah, blah, blah.
I'm needing more money.
Yeah.
And then going, how much are you getting? I don't. Yeah. I always remember the accountants meetings. You're like band accountants meetings. Like, what? Like, where have we got to? And they go like, okay, now he's going to want a Rolls Royce, but you're happy with a bicycle. But let me tell you guys, down the road, the story. No, he can have the Rolls Royce. He didn't have one anyway, but whoever he was. Yeah. I'd be fine with the bicycle until the day you stop.
Yeah. Right. The one thing I am grateful for the Cure's first accountant, and I think he's probably still their accountant today. Very nice man from North London. He said to me when I was about 22, well, you're making money now, so you might as well start a pension fund, right? And I was like, what do I need a bloody pension for? I'm 21. I'm never going to need a pension. You know, this is obviously going to continue forever, and I'm going to be making millions until, you know, why am I going to need a pension? And he went, trust me, you'll need it. And, you know, now I'm like, you know, I'm 62. Yeah, I'm very glad that he suggested that at that particular point, you know. Yeah. But, of course, back then you don't know anything about it all, you know.
No, it's incredible, isn't it? You're immortal till you're 35, aren't you?
And then, absolutely. Yeah.
And then you think about it until you're 50. And after 50, it's like,
fuck,
you know, hang on.
Well, I don't know if it's the same for you guys, but like, I didn't like turning 50. I didn't like turning 50 because I thought to myself, somebody said to me, oh yes, 50, the youth of old age. And I thought, you bastard, you've said it to me. I said, I can't say I'm a young guy anymore. That's it. It's gone. 50, you can't do it. But at 60, I really, really liked 60, because 60, I thought, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter anymore. It's like, you know, I can just be who I want to be. It doesn't matter. It doesn't, you know, I know some things, I don't know everything, but it really doesn't matter. I felt this sense of liberation, you know. Was that the same for you?
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, I'm good with that. Yeah, I like I say, you know, how are you, Horace? I have very little to complain about, to be honest.
Yes.
You know, yeah.
Right.
Apart from the knees and the backache.
Well, yeah, the knees and your back, but, you know, like we're still compass mentis, still got most of our marbles, you know. Life is good, you know, we're very grateful for a lot of things, you know, just like, and it's mostly about relationships.
Okay, can I tell you my Cure joke, my Cure anecdote, which was like when the Specials, we'd signed our deal and we did some festivals in Europe. And the first thing we would ask was like, are the Cure on the bill? And we find out that they were. We go, oh, great. Because you guys had a guitar tuner. You had a core, a little core thing. It was about this.
Oh, the stroboscopic one.
No. It was before all that. It was a tiny little thing. It was about the size. I don't know what it was the size of. But it was a tiny little thing. But we could plug our guitars in it and get our, because we didn't have, I don't know why we didn't have a guitar tuner, but you guys did. So it was really pleased. I was really pleased. Oh, great. We can borrow their guitar tuner. It's great. So you pretty much saved our lives in early 79.
And look at it. Look at it. 40 years later, here we are. Yeah. Best of mates. Yeah. There you go.
That's because you've got the guitar tuner.
Yeah. It's all about that.
Well, thank you for the memories and thank you for the updates.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you. It's good. This has been lovely. Thank you.
Oh, lovely.
Thank you.
Oh, what a pleasure.
Good night.
Well, best. Take care. Good night.
Bye. Bye.
Here we have a question for me and you both, which is kind of a loaded question, I think.
Loaded with loaded. What? Yes.
Well, it can go on for hours and hours. This one.
Oh, I see. Well, okay. Yes, we're good at those.
Joseph Balandran. Joseph, greetings. And he's in California as well.
Hi, Joseph.
Kind of a double question for you both. Do you have a favorite song you loved performing live? And are there any songs you did not enjoy for a particular reason? Also, is there an album you look back with the most fondness and one you were not so proud of the outcome? Joseph from California. I think those questions are open-ended, but they're also, they probably connect together. I mean, at least they do. For me, but what's your experience?
They change. They're always changing.
Right.
It really depends. I've just been reading Chrissy Hynde's memoir, and so it threw me back to a particular time in London. You know, probably the time I arrived there.
Right.
And thinking of my introduction to Susie and the Banshees, which would be Kaleidoscope.
Right.
Which had an array of other people played, guitarist Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols, John McGeoch. But it was probably the album after that where we felt like a band, proper. And that contained, in fact, both of answers to both those questions. So it would be Juju, which was just a great feeling in the studio. I think it would be possibly what were high points to play. And don't forget, we didn't have that many songs at that point.
Right.
And so having been involved in just two albums and played the first two albums, it's a long answer, but it would be Night Shift, Voodoo Dolly. I think those two somehow would, you know, I think my answer would probably be Voodoo Dolly was a favorite because it, of all of the songs we played in those early days, it was the one that had the most freedom, really. It could take us anywhere. It could be extended. It could be shift gears many times. So it really was dependent on the moment. It still had a structure. It had a beginning and an end. We knew where we were in it, but all those parts could be slightly more flexible than probably any other song we did. I think that's the first half of the question.
Second half is the same thing for tracks on the album, sort of like which ones did you like, which ones you didn't like?
I think one that really challenged me was Into the Light. I would play it differently now than I played it then.
Yeah, I think that's the truth about a lot of things, isn't it, in music. You know, I listen to people play songs that may be 40, 50 years old, and they don't sound anything like they sounded on the first record or whatever. Yeah.
Well, I was interested in doing lots of eighth notes, you know, with like my bass drum or the floor tom, it just felt like the right thing to be doing. Now I'd probably half the number and do a combination some other way, suggesting that kind of thing.
Suggesting that movement, but not just like, yeah, not the, the accuracy hi-hats with, you know, one hand doing 16ths.
No. Very difficult. There was another part to the question, wasn't there? There was a part of...
Yeah, it was about the same question for albums. You know, which one did you really enjoy? Which one did you not enjoy?
Oh, gosh. It's funny, isn't it? And the one that I look back and think I least enjoyed, for some reason, Superstition. But it's only to do with circumstances. It's not to do, it's not to do with what the album or the music or the writing. It's to do with the process.
Well, I suppose the truth is that, you know, what's that saying? Art doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, if you're having a good experience of life, then you'll have a good experience of the art you're doing at the same time, usually, you know. And if you're having a crap experience of life, then you could tend to think, oh, that was crap. And it might have been very good. Yeah,
I think also the other side of that is that, you know, vice versa. You could be having a bad time and yet producing great stuff, but you just don't think it is.
Right, and that's happened to me a few times, for sure.
And then looking back, you think, wow, you know, we certainly did with, I think with Hyena, maybe not so much of Superstition, but with Hyena, we just felt like it hadn't worked. Yeah. And the press were sort of not so complimentary. We probably read and believed the press too much. And looking back, when we were probably remastering, going like, hang on, this is really like a strong album. So it can be to do, you know, with the circumstance, with the other pressures outside, the speed at which you had to come up with the goods. What about you, Lol? What about you?
What about me? Well, I have a couple. There's two songs that I really enjoyed playing live, drums, and then there's a song that I really enjoyed playing live, keyboards. But for different reasons. So All Cats Grey I enjoyed playing live because it's quite a sort of mantra of a beat for me to play. And once I could get into the correct timing for it, it would become very soothing to me to do. And you know, it holds the whole song together because there's only, you know, three of us. And if that falls apart, everything falls apart. And I was happy that most of the time it didn't fall apart. Very rarely did it go skew whiff, as they say. So I enjoyed playing that. And that was quite hard to do at first in the studio, but then live, you know, I found a way to do it live that would make it work. And I was happy with that. And then the other one was a song off of Pornography, Cold, because I love the thundering of the beginning, you know, just bashing in like, and I love that. And it has a great line to come into the song. So I enjoyed that. On keyboards, I actually enjoyed playing Push, not for the keyboards. It wasn't for the keyboards. It was for the lights, because I don't know if you recall, there was a point where nobody had those very lights, you know, that flashed all over the place, right? But then suddenly we had a big box of them, and at the beginning of Push, there's sort of like a long entry, and then just before Robert starts to sing, there's this sort of big breath, and it's kind of like, you know, when the sea comes up to the front of the beach, and then it pulls back, and you hear all the sort of like the shale and everything getting sucked out to sea. And then this big wave comes crashing in. And that's what he did with the very lights. And I loved watching that every time. You know, it's just like, I knew it was coming. The first tour, the audience didn't know it was coming. After that, they kind of knew it was coming. But the first time, to watch their faces as they were sort of like, whoa, you know, he swung his head out at that point. To look at all the lights going over the top of their heads and then swirling around in them, you know, it was kind of magical. So I like that one. Albums to do. Back to that question of, you know, having a bad time but making some good album. Mm. You know, that was very true for like Faith and Pornography. You know, they weren't, you know, the most jolly of times for either any of us. But I think actually I'm very pleased listening back to it years later with what we did. And then there were albums that were hard and difficult to make that are not my favorites. Like, you know, I kind of listen to Kiss Me and it's very long. It has a lot of songs on it. And I like a lot of the songs individually, but as a whole album, it has a lot of memories that are not great. So, you know, I don't sort of think back to it and go, oh, that reminds me of here and that reminds you of then. You know, I think that's true of a lot of stuff that you do, you know, artistically. If you don't feel happy or connected, you have to have something that's really good as well. Because, you know, if you feel happy and connected, you usually turn out something that's good. But if you're not happy and connected and it's sounding bad and you're sounding bad and everything's sounding bad and life is sounding bad, then you're probably going to end up with something that sounds bad. And that happened a few times with The Cure, where we would walk into the studio and after a week we'd go, yeah, no, we should leave now and come back later because it's not going to work. I mean, we did that with some singles. If I think correctly, before we did The Walk, you know, we had been in the studio for a little while, and for same studio that we end up recording The Walk in, and we were there for about a week, and we did all the usual things that we thought would make it come alive, like call up Julian's Hire and let's get the Latin American box. Yes, okay, so we get all the funny things to play, you know.
Yeah.
And then call get them a steel guitar. Right, so Robert had to go with the steel guitar. And we were sitting there for about a week, you know, and then we're like, this is crap. Let's just go, you know, and we'll come back later and we'll do something. So, you know, you have to be, it's kind of like, what's that saying? You know, most of it is 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. But, so you have to do the work, but you also have to be aware of when, you know, you're working against yourself, I think.
Yeah. Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Butchie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cure Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2022.